Random House Audiobooks presents O is for Outlaw by Sue Grafton. Read for you by Judy Kay.
Just a note to clarify the time frame of these alphabet novels. For those of you confused about what appear to be errors in my calculation of ages and dates, please be aware that A is for Alibi takes place in May of 1982. B is for Burglar in June of 1982. C is for Corpse in August of 1982, and so forth. Since the books are sequential, Kinsey Millhone's life proceeds at a much slower pace than the rest of us experience. In consequence, Miss Millhone is caught up in a time warp. Through no fault of her own, she is currently living and working in the year 1986, without access to cell phones, the internet, or the high-tech equipment presently used by private investigators in tracking missing persons, establishing background information, and gathering financial data. She relies instead on persistence, imagination, and ingenuity, the stock in trade of the traditional gumshoe throughout hard-boiled history. A moment may come when I take a tuck in narrative time and allow her to hop, skip, and jump into the present, without forcing her to be victimized by the normal aging process. For now, as her biographer, I tend to avoid mention of topical issues or date-specific affairs. You'll find few, if any, references to the latest music, movies, fads, fashions, or current events. This book is an exception in its references to the Vietnam War. Given narrative requirements, I populate historical episodes with several fictional characters. I also project certain fictional persons into academic institutions and political arenas in which their real-life counterparts will doubtless dispute their presence. In my view, the delight of fiction is its enhancement of the facts and its embellishment of reality. Aside from that, as my father used to say, I know it's all true because I made it up myself. Respectfully submitted, Sue Grafton. O is for Outlaw. The Latin term pro bono, as most attorneys will attest, roughly translated means for boneheads and applies to work done without charge. Not that I practice law, but I am usually smart enough to avoid having to donate my services. In this case, my client was in a coma, which made billing a trick. Of course, you might look at the situation from another point of view. Once in a while, a piece of old business services, some item on life's agenda you thought you'd dealt with years ago, suddenly, it's there again at the top of the page, competing for your attention despite the fact that you're completely unprepared for it. First, there was a phone call from a stranger, then a letter showed up 14 years after it was sent. That's how I learned I'd made a serious error in judgment and ended up risking my life in my attempt to correct for it. I just finished a big job and I was not only exhausted, but my bank account was fat, and I wasn't in the mood to take on additional work. I'd pictured a bit of time off, maybe a trip someplace cheap, where I could lounge in the sun and read the new Elmore Leonard novel while sipping on a rum drink with a paper umbrella buried in a piece of fruit. This is about the range and complexity of my fantasies these days. The call came at 8 a.m., Monday, May 19th, while I was off at the gym. I'd started lifting weights again, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings after my 6 a.m. run. I'm not sure where the motivation came from after a 2-year layoff, but it was probably related to thoughts of mortality, primarily my own. In the spring, I'd sustained damage to my right hand when a fellow dislocated two fingers trying to persuade me to his point of view. I'd been hurt once before when a bullet nicked my right arm, and my impulse in both instances had been to hit the weight machines. Lest you imagine I'm a masochist or accident prone, I should state that I make a living as a private investigator. Truth be told, the average PI seldom carries a gun, isn't often pursued, and rarely sustains an injury more substantial than a paper cut. But my own professional life tends to be as dull as anyone else's. I simply report the exceptions in the interest of spiritual enlightenment. Processing events helps me keep my head on straight. Those of you acquainted with my personal data can skip this paragraph. For the uninitiated, I'm female, 36 years old, twice divorced, and living in Santa Teresa, California, which is 95 miles north of Los Angeles. Currently, I occupy one small office in the larger suite of offices of Kingman and Ives, attorneys at law. Lonnie Kingman is my attorney when the occasion arises, and my association with his firm seemed to make sense when I was looking for space. I'd been rendered a migrant after I was unceremoniously shit-canned from the last job I had, investigating arson and wrongful death claims for California Fidelity Insurance. I've been with Lonnie now for over 2 years, but I'm not above harboring a petty desire for revenge on CFI. During the months I'd been lifting weights, my muscle tone had improved and my strength had increased. That particular morning, I'd worked my way through the customary body parts, 2 sets, 15 reps each of leg extensions, leg curls, ab crunches, lower back, lat rows, the chest press and pec deck, along with the shoulder press and various exercises for the biceps and triceps. Thus, pumped up and euphoric, I let myself into my apartment with the usual glance at my answering machine. The message light was blinking. I dropped my gym bag on the floor, tossed my keys on the desk, and pressed the play button, reaching for a pen and a pad of paper in case I needed to take notes. Before I leave the office each day, I have Lonnie's service shunt calls over to my apartment. That way, in a pinch, I can lie abed all day dealing with the public without putting on my clothes. The voice was male, somewhat gravelly, and the message sounded like this.
Miss Milhone, this is Teddy Rich. I'm calling from Olvidado about something might interest you. This is 8 a.m. Monday. Hope it's not too early. Give me a call when you can. Thanks.
He recited a telephone number in the 805 area code, and I dutifully jotted it down. It was only 8:23, so I hadn't missed him by much. Olvidado is a town of 157,000, 30 miles south of Santa Teresa on Highway 101. Always one to be interested in something that might interest me, I dialed the number he'd left. The ringing went on so long I thought his machine would kick in. But the line was finally picked up by Mr. Rich, whose distinctive voice I recognized.
Hi, Mr. Rich. This is Kinsey Milhone up in Santa Teresa. I'm returning your call.
Hey, Miss Milhone. Nice to hear from you. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for asking, and thanks for being so prompt. I appreciate that.
Sure, no problem. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm hoping this is something I can do for you, he said. I'm a storage space scavenger. Are you familiar with the term?
I'm afraid not. I pulled the chair out and sat down, realizing Ted Rich was going to take his sweet time about this. I'd already pegged him as a salesman or a huckster, someone thoroughly enamored of whatever minor charms he possessed. I didn't want what he was selling, but I decided I might as well hear him out. This business of storage space scavenging was a new one on me, and I gave him points for novelty. He said,
I won't bore you with the details. Basically, I bid on the contents of self-storage lockers when the monthly payment's in arrears.
I didn't know they did that on delinquent accounts. Sounds reasonable, I suppose. I took the towel from my gym bag and roughed it across my head. My hair was still damp from the workout, and I was getting chillier by the minute, longing to hit the shower before my muscles stiffened up.
Oh, sure. Storage unit's been abandoned by its owner for more than 60 days. The contents go up for auction. How else can the company recoup its losses? Guys like me show up and blind bid on the contents, paying anywhere from $200 to $1,500, hoping for a hit.
As in what? I reached down, untied my sockinies, and slipped them off my feet. My gym socks smelled atrocious, and I'd only worn them a week.
Well, most times you get junk. But once in a while, you get lucky and come across some good. Tools, furniture, stuff you can convert to hard cash. I'm sure you're probably curious what this has to do with you.
It crossed my mind, I said mildly, anticipating his pitch. For mere pennies a day, you two can acquire abandoned bric-a-brac with which to clutter up your own premises.
Yeah, right. Anyways, this past Saturday, I bid on a couple storage bins. Neither of them netted much, but in the process, I picked up a bunch of cardboard boxes. I was sorting through the contents, and I came across your name on some personal documents. I'm wondering what it's worth to you to get them back.
What kind of documents?
Well, let me see here. Hold on. Frankly, I didn't expect to hear so soon, or I'd have had them on the desk in front of me.
I could hear him rattling papers in the background.
Okay, now. We got a diploma from Santa Teresa Junior High, and there's quite a collection of school-type memorabilia. Drawings, class pictures, report cards from Woodrow Wilson Elementary. Is ringing any bells with you?
My name's on these papers?
Kinsey Milhone, right? Milhone with two L's. Oh, here's a history report entitled San Juan Capistrano Mission with a model of the mission made of egg cartons. Mrs. Rosen's class, fourth grade. She gave you a D+. Report is not bad, but project is poorly presented, she says. I had a teacher like her once. What a bitch, he said idly. Oh, and here's something else. Diploma says you graduated Santa Teresa High School June 10th, 1967. How am I doing so far?
Not bad.
Well, there you go, he said.
Not that it matters, but how'd you track me down?
Piece of cake. All I did was call directory assistance. The name Milhone's unusual, so I figure it's like the old saying goes, apples don't fall far from the tree and so forth. I proceeded on the assumption you were somewheres close. You could have gotten married and changed your name, of course. I took a flyer on that score. Anyways, the point is, how'd you feel about getting these things back?
I don't understand how the stuff ended up in Olvidado. I've never rented storage space down there. I could hear him begin to hedge.
I never said Olvidado. Did I say that? I go to these auctions all over the state. Look, I don't mean to sound crass, but if you're willing to pony up a few bucks, we could maybe make arrangements for you to get this box back.
I hesitated, annoyed by the clumsiness of his maneuvering. I remembered my struggle in Mrs. Rosen's class, how crushed I'd been with the grade after I'd worked so hard. The fact was, I had so little in the way of personal keepsakes that any addition would be treasured. I didn't want to pay much, but neither was I willing to relinquish the items sight unseen. I said, the papers can't be worth much since I wasn't aware they were missing. Already I didn't like him, and I hadn't even met him yet.
Hey, I'm not here to argue. I don't intend to hose you or nothing like that. You want to talk value, we'll talk value. Up to you, he said.
Why don't I think about it and call you back?
Well, that's just it. If we could find time to get together, you could take a look at these items and then come to a decision. How else you gonna know if it's worth anything to you? It'd mean a drive down here, but I'm assuming you got wheels.
I could do that, I suppose.
Excellent, he said. So what's your schedule like today?
Today?
No time like the present is my attitude.
What's the big hurry?
No hurry in particular, except I got appointments set up for the rest of the week. I make money turning stuff over, and my garage is already packed. Have you got time today or not?
I could probably manage it.
Good. Then let's meet as soon as possible and see if we can work something out. There's a coffee shop down the street from me. I'm on my way over now, and I'll be there for about an hour. Let's say 9:30, 9:45. You don't show? I gotta make a run to the dump anyways, so it's no skin off my nose.
What'd you have in mind?
Money-wise? Let's say $30. How's that sound?
Exorbitant, I said. I asked him for directions. What a hairball. I showered and flung on the usual blue jeans and T-shirt, then gassed up my VW and headed south on 101. The drive to Olvidado took 25 minutes. Following Ted Rich's instructions, I took the Olvidado Avenue exit and turned right at the bottom of the off-ramp. Half a block from the freeway, there was a large shopping mall. The surrounding land, originally given over to agricultural use, was gradually being converted to a crop of new and used cars. Lines of snapping plastic flags defined tent shapes above the asphalt lot where rows of vehicles glinted in the mild May sun. I could see a shark-shaped mini-blimp tethered and hovering 30 feet in the air. The significance escaped me, but what do I know about these things? Across from the mall, the business establishment seemed to be equally divided among fast food joints, liquor stores, and instant copy shops that offered passport photos. There was even a facility devoted to walk-in legal services. Litigate while you wait. Bankruptcy, $99. Divorce, $99. Divorce with kids, $99, plus filing fee. Se habla español. The coffee shop he'd specified appeared to be the only mom-and-pop operation in the area. I parked my car in the lot and pushed into the place, scanning the few patrons for someone who fit his description. He'd indicated he was 6'2" and movie star handsome, but then he'd snorted with laughter, which led me to believe otherwise. He'd said he'd watched the door for my arrival. I spotted a guy who raised a hand in greeting and beckoned me to his booth. His face was a big ruddy square, his sunburn extending into the V of his open-collared denim work shirt. He wore his dark hair combed straight back, and I could see the indentation at his temples where he'd removed the baseball cap now sitting on the table next to him. He had a wide nose, drooping upper lids, and bags under his eyes. I could see the scattering of whiskers he'd missed during his morning shave. His shoulders were beefy and his forearms looked thick where he had his sleeves rolled up. He'd removed a dark brown windbreaker that now lay neatly folded over the back of the booth. "Mr. Rich? Kinsey Milhone, how are you?" We shook hands across the table and I could tell he was sizing me up with the same attention to detail I'd just lavished on him.
"Make it Teddy. Not bad. I appreciate your coming."
He glanced at his watch as I slid in across from him.
"Unfortunately, I only got maybe 15-20 minutes before I have to take off. I apologize for the squeeze, but right after we spoke, I had a call from some guy down in Thousand Oaks needs an estimate on his roof."
"You're a roofer?"
"By trade."
He reached in his pants pocket.
"Let me pass you my card in case you need something done."
He took out a slim naugahyde case and removed a stack of business cards.
"My specialty is new roofs and repairs."
"What else is there?"
"Hey, I can do anything you need. Hot mops, tear-offs, torch-downs, all types of shake, composition, slate, clay tile, you name it. Corrective and preventative is my area of expertise. I could give you a deal, let's say 10% off if you call this month. What kind of house you in?"
"Rented."
"So maybe you got a landlord, needs some roof work done. Go ahead and keep that. Take as many as you want."
He offered me a handful of cards, fanned out face down like he was about to do a magic trick. I took one and examined it. The card bore his name, telephone number, and a post office box. His company was called Overhead Roofing, the letters forming a wide inverted V-like ridgeline of a roof. His company motto was, "We do all types of roofing." "Catchy," I remarked. He'd been watching for my reaction, his expression serious.
"I just had those made. Came up with the name myself. Used to be Ted's Roofs. You know, simple, basic, something of a personal touch. I could have said Rich Roofs, but that might have gave the wrong impression. I was in business 10 years, but then the drought came along and the market dried up."
"So to speak," I put in. He smiled, showing a small gap between his two front lower teeth.
"Hey, that's good. I like your sense of humor. You'll appreciate this one. Couple of years without rain and people start to take a roof for granite. Get it? Granite, like to rock."
I said, "That's funny."
"Anyways, I've had a hell of a time. I had to shut down altogether and file bankruptcy. My wife up and left me. The dog died, and then my truck got sideswiped. I was screwed big time. Now we got some bad weather coming in, I figured I'd start fresh." Overhead roofing is a kind of play on words.
"Really?" I said. What about the storage space business? Where did that come from?
I figured I had to do something when the roofing trade fell in, as it were, he added with a wink at me. I decided to try salvage. I had some cash tucked away the wife and the creditors didn't know about, so I used that to get started. Takes 5 or 6,000 if you want to do it right. I got hosed once or twice, but otherwise I've been doing pretty good, even if I do say so myself.
He caught the waitress's attention and held his coffee cup in the air with a glance back at me.
Can I buy you a cup of coffee?
That sounds good. How long have you been at it?
About a year, he said. We're called pickers, or storage room gamblers, sometimes resellers, treasure hunters. How it works is I check the papers for auction listings. I also subscribe to a couple newsletters. You never know what you'll find. A couple of weeks ago, I paid $250 and found a painting worth more than $1,500. I was jazzed.
I can imagine.
Of course, there's rules to the practice, like anything else in life. You can't touch the room's contents, can't go inside before the bidding starts, and there's no refunds. You pay $600 and all you come up with is a stack of old magazine, and then it's too bad for you. Such is life and all that.
Can you make a living at it? He shifted in his seat.
Not so as you'd notice. This is strictly a hobby in between roofing engagements. Nice thing about it is it doesn't look good on paper, so the wife can't hit me up for alimony. She was the one who walked out, so up hers is what I say.
The waitress appeared at the table with a coffee pot in hand, refilling his cup and pouring one for me. Teddy and the waitress exchanged pleasantries. I took the moment to add milk to my coffee and then tore the corner off a pack of sugar, which I don't ordinarily take. Anything to fill time till they finished their conversation. Frankly, I thought he had the hots for her. Once she departed, Teddy turned his attention to me. I could see the box on the seat beside him. He noticed my glance.
I can see you're curious. Want a peek?
I said, sure. I made a move toward the box, and Teddy put a hand out, saying,
give me $5 first.
Then he laughed.
You should have seen the look on your face. Come on, I'm teasing. Help yourself.
He hefted the box and passed it across the table. It was maybe 36 inches square, awkward but not heavy, the cardboard powdery with dust. The top had been sealed, but I could see where the packing tape had been cut and the flaps folded back together. I set the box on the seat beside me and pulled the flaps apart. The contents seemed hastily thrown together with no particular thought paid to the organization. It was rather like the last of the cartons packed in the moving process. Stuff you don't dare throw out, but don't really know what else to do with. A box like this could probably sit unopened in your basement for the next 10 years, and nothing would ever stimulate a search for even one of the items. On the other hand, if you felt the need to inventory the contents, you'd still feel too attached to the items to toss the assortment in the trash. The next time you moved, you'd end up adding the box to the other boxes on the van, gradually accumulating sufficient junk to fill a storage bin. I could tell at a glance these were articles I wanted. In addition to the grade school souvenirs, I spotted the high school diploma he'd mentioned, my yearbook, some textbooks, and more importantly, file after file of mimeographed pages from my classes at the police academy. $30 was nothing for this treasury of remembrances. Teddy was watching my face, trying to gauge the dollar signs in my reaction. I found myself avoiding eye contact, lest he sense the extent of my interest. Stalling, I said, whose storage space was it? I don't believe you mentioned that.
Guy named John Russell. He a friend of yours?
I wouldn't call him a friend, but I know him, I said. Actually, that's an in-joke like an alias. John Russell is a character in an Elmore Leonard novel called Ombre.
Well, I tried to get a hold of him, but I didn't have much luck. Way too many Russells in this part of the state. A couple of dozen Johns, 10 or 15 Jacks, but none were him because I checked it out.
You put some time in.
You bet. Took me a couple hours before I gave up and said nuts. I tried this whole area. Perdido, L.A. County, Orange, San Bernardino, Santa Teresa County, as far up as San Luis. There's no sign of the guy, so I figure he's dead or moved out of state.
I took a sip of my coffee, avoiding comment. The addition of milk and sugar made the coffee taste like a piece of hard candy. Teddy tilted his head at me with an air of bemusement.
So you're a private detective? I notice you're listed as Milhone Investigations.
That's right. I was a cop for 2 years, which is how I knew John.
The guy's a cop?
Not now, but he was in those days.
I wouldn't have guessed that. I mean, judging from the crap he had jammed in that space, I'd have said some kind of bum. That's the impression I got.
Some people would agree.
But you're not one of them, I take it.
I shrugged, saying nothing. Teddy studied me shrewdly.
Who's this guy to you?
What makes you ask?
Come on. What's his real name? Maybe I can track him down for you, like a missing persons case.
Why bother? We haven't spoken in years, so he's nothing to me.
But now you got me curious. Why the alias?
He was a vice cop in the late 60s and early 70s. Big dope busts back then. John worked undercover, so he was always paranoid about his real name.
Sounds like a nut.
Maybe so, I said. What else was in the bin? He waved a hand dismissively.
Most of it was useless. Lawn mower, broken down vacuum cleaner. There was a big box of kitchen stuff, wooden rolling pin, big wooden salad bowl, must have been 3 feet across the top, set of crockery bowls. What do you call it, at Fiesta Ware shit. I picked up a fair chunk of change for that. Ski equipment, tennis rackets, none of it in prime condition. It was an old bicycle, motorcycle engine, wheel cover, and some car parts. I figure Russell was a pack rat, couldn't let go of stuff. I sold most of it at the local swap meet this was yesterday.
I felt my heart sink. The big wooden bowl had belonged to my Aunt Jin. I didn't care about the Fiesta ware, though that was hers as well. I was wishing I'd had the option to buy the wooden rolling pin. Aunt Jin had used it to make sticky buns, one of her few domestic skills, rolling out the dough before she sprinkled on the cinnamon and sugar. I had to let that one go. No point in longing for what had already been disposed of. Odd to think an item would suddenly have such appeal when I hadn't thought of it in years. He nodded at the box.
$30 and it's yours.
$20. It's barely worth that. It's all junk.
$25. Come on, for the trip down memory lane. Things like that you're never going to see again. Sentimental journey and so forth. Might as well snap it up while you have the chance.
I removed a 20 from my handbag and laid it on the table. Nobody else is going to pay you a dime. Teddy shrugged.
So I toss it. Who cares? 25 and that's firm.
Teddy, a dump run would cost you 15, so this puts you $5 ahead. He stared at the money, flicked a look to my face, and then took the bill with an exaggerated sigh of disgust with himself.
Lucky I like you, or I'd be pissed as hell.
He folded the 20 lengthwise and tucked it in his pocket.
You never answered my question.
Which one?
Who's this guy to you?
No one in particular. A friend, once upon a time. Not that it's any of your business.
Oh, I see. I get it. Now he's a friend. Interesting development. You must have been close to the guy if he ended up with your things.
What makes you say that? He tapped his temple.
I got a logical mind. Analytical, right? I bet I could be a peeper just like you.
Gee, Teddy, sure. I don't see why not. The truth is, I stored some boxes at John's while I was in the middle of a move. My stuff must have gotten mixed up with his when he left Santa Teresa. By the way, which storage company? His expression turned crafty.
What makes you ask?
He said in a slightly mocking tone. Because I'm wondering if John's still in the area somewhere. Teddy shook his head way ahead of me.
No go. Forget it. You'd be wasting your time. I mean, look at it this way. If the guy used a phony name, he probably also faked his phone number and his home address. Why contact the company? They won't tell you nothing.
I'll bet I could get the information. That's what I do for a living these days.
You and Dick Tracy?
All I'm asking is the name. Teddy smiled.
How much is it worth?
How much is it worth?
Yeah, let's do a little business. $20.
Don't be silly. I'm not going to pay you. That's ridiculous.
So make me an offer. I'm a reasonable guy.
Bullshit.
All I'm saying is you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours.
There can't be that many storage companies in the area.
1,511, if you take in the neighboring counties. For $10, I'll tell you which little town it's in.
No way.
Come on. How else are you going to find out?
I'm sure I can think of something.
Want to bet? 5 says you can't.
I glanced at my watch and slid out of the seat. I wish I could chat, Teddy, but you have that appointment and I have to get to work.
Why don't you call me if you change your mind? We could find them together. We could form us a partnership. I bet you could use a guy with my connections.
No doubt. I picked up the cardboard box and made a few more polite mouth noises and returned to my car. I placed the box in the passenger seat and then slid in on the driver's side. I locked both doors instinctively and blew out a big breath. My heart was thumping and I could feel the damp of perspiration in the small of my back. John Russell was the alias for a former Santa Teresa vice detective named Mickey Magruder. My first ex-husband. What the hell was going on? I slouched down in my car, scanning the parking lot from my position at half-mast. I could see a white pickup parked at the rear of the lot, the truck bed filled with the sort of buckets and tarps I pictured essential to a roofing magnate. An oversized toolbox rested near the back of the cab, and an aluminum extension ladder seemed to be mounted on the far side with its two metal anti-slip shoes protruding about a foot. I adjusted the rear-view mirror, watching until Ted Rich came out of the coffee shop, wearing his baseball cap and brown windbreaker. He had his hands in his pants pockets, and he whistled to himself as he walked to the pickup and fished out his keys. When I heard the truck rumble to life, I took a moment to lean sideways out of his line of sight. As soon as he passed, I sat up again, watching as he turned left and entered the line of traffic, heading toward the southbound freeway on-ramp. I waited till he was gone, then got out of the VW and trotted to the public phone booth near the entrance to the parking lot. I placed his business card on the narrow metal shelf provided, hauled up the phone book, and checked under the listings for United States government. I found the number I was looking for and dug some loose change from the bottom of my shoulder bag. I inserted coins in the slot and dialed the number for the local post office branch printed on Rich's business card. The phone rang twice and a recorded message was activated, subjecting me to the usual reassurances. All the lines were busy at the moment, but my call would be answered in the order it was received. According to the recording, the post office really appreciated my patience, which shows you just how little they know about yours truly. When a live female clerk finally came on the line, I gave her the box number for overhead roofing, possibly known as Ted's Roofs. Within minutes, she'd checked the rental agreement for his post office box and had given me the corresponding street address. I said thanks and depressed the plunger. I put another coin in the slot and punched in the phone number listed on the business card. As I suspected, no one answered, though Rich's machine did pick up promptly. I was happy to hear that Ted Rich was Olvidado's number one certified master installer of fire-free roofing materials. The message also indicated that May was weatherproofing month, which I hadn't realized. More importantly, Teddy wasn't home, and neither apparently was anyone else. I returned to the car, fished an Olvidado city map from the glove compartment, and found the street listed on the ledger. By tracing the number and the letter coordinates, I pinpointed the location, not far from where I sat. Oh, happiness. I turned the key in the ignition, put the car in reverse, and in less than 5 minutes I was idling in front of Teddy's house, whence he operated his roofing business. I found a parking spot 6 doors down and then sat in the car while my good angel and my bad angel jousted for possession of my soul. My good angel reminded me I'd vowed to reform. She recited the occasions when my usual vile behavior had brought me naught but grief and pain, as she put it. Which was all well and good, but as my bad angel asserted, this was really the only chance I was going to have to get the information I wanted. If Rich had shared the name of the storage company, I wouldn't have to do this, so it was really all his fault. He was currently on his way to Thousand Oaks to give an estimate on some guy's roof. The round-trip drive would take approximately 30 minutes, with another 30 minutes thrown in for schmoozing, which is how men do business. The two of us had parted company at 10. It was now 10:15, so, with luck, he wouldn't be back for another 45 minutes. I removed my key picks from my shoulder bag, which I had left on the back seat under the pile of assorted clothes I keep there. Often in the course of surveillance work, I use camouflage garments, like a quick-change artist, to vary my appearance. Now I pulled out a pair of navy coveralls that looked suitably professional. The patch on the sleeve, which I'd had stitched to my specifications, read Santa Teresa City Services and suggested I was employed by the Public Works Department. I figured from a distance the Olvidado citizens would never know the difference. Wriggling around in the driver's seat, I pulled the coverall over my usual jeans and t-shirt. I tugged up the front zipper and tucked my key picks in one pocket. I reached for the matching clipboard with its stack of generic paperwork, then locked the car behind me and walked as far as Ted Rich's gravel drive. There were no vehicles parked anywhere near the house. I climbed the front steps and rang the doorbell. I waited, leafing through the papers on the clipboard, making an officious-looking note with the pen attached by a chain. I rang again, but there was no reply. Kel's surprise. I moved to the front window, shading my eyes as I peered through the glass. Aside from the fact that there was no sign of the occupant, the place had the look of a man accustomed to living by himself, an aura epitomized by the presence of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle in the middle of the dining room. Casually, I glanced around. There was no one on the sidewalk and no hint of neighbors watching from across the way. Nonetheless, I frowned, making a big display of my puzzlement. I checked my watch to show that I, at least, was on time for our imaginary appointment. I trotted down the front steps and headed back along the driveway to the rear of the house. The backyard was fenced and the shrubbery had grown up tall enough to touch the utility wires strung along the property line. The yard was deserted. Both sectional doors of the two-car garage were closed and showed hefty padlocks. I climbed the back porch steps and then checked to see if any neighbors were busy dialing 911. Once assured of my privacy, I peeped in the kitchen window. The lights were off in the rooms within view. I tried the door handle. Locked. I stared at the Schlage, wondering how long it would take before it yielded to my key picks. Glancing down at knee height, I noticed that the bottom half of the door panel boasted a sizable homemade pet entrance. Well, what have we here? I reached down, gave the flap a push, and found myself staring at a section of kitchen linoleum. I thought back to Ted Rich's reference to his divorce and the death of his beloved pooch. The opening to the doggy door appeared to be large enough to me. I set the clipboard on the porch rail and got down on my hands and knees. At 5'6" and 118 pounds, I had only minor difficulties in my quest for admittance. Arms above my head, my body tilted to the diagonal, I began to ease myself through the opening. Once I'd succeeded squeezing my head and shoulders through the door, I paused for a quick appraisal to assure myself there was no one else in residence. My one-sided view was restricted to the chrome and formica dinette set, littered with dirty dishes and the big plastic clock on the wall above. I inched forward, rotating my body so I could see the rest of the room. Now that I was halfway through the doggy door, it dawned on me that maybe I should have asked Rich if he'd acquired a new mutt. To my left, at eye level, I could see a 2-quart water bowl and a large plastic dish filled with dry dog food. Nearby, a rawhide bone sported teeth marks that appeared to have been inflicted by a creature with a surly disposition. Half a second later, the object of my speculation appeared on the scene. He'd probably been alerted by the noise, and he came skidding around the corner to see what was up. I'm not dog-oriented by nature, and I hardly know one breed from the next, with the exception of Chihuahuas, Cocker Spaniels, and other obvious types. This dog was big, maybe 80 pounds of lean weight on a heavily boned frame. What the hell was he doing while I was ringing the bell? The least he could have done was bark properly to warn me off. The dog was a medium brown with a big face, thick head, and a short, sleek coat. He was heavy through the chest and had a dick the size of a hairy 6-inch Gloria Cubana. A ruff of coarse hair was standing up along his spine as though from permanent outrage. He stopped in his tracks and stood there, his expression a perfect blend of confusion and incredulity. I could almost see the question mark forming above his head. Apparently, in his experience, few human beings tried to slither through his private entrance. I ceased struggling to allow him time to assess the situation. I must not have represented any immediate threat because he neither lunged, nor barked, nor bit me cruelly about the head and shoulders. On the contrary, he seemed to feel that something was required of him in the way of polite behavior, though I could tell he was having trouble deciding what would be appropriate. He made a whining sound, dropped to his belly, and crept across the floor to me. I stayed where I was. For a while we lay face to face while I suffered his meaty breath and he thought about life. Me and dogs always seem to end up in relationships like this. "Hi, how are you?" I said finally, in what I hoped was a pleasant tone, from the dog's perspective. He put his head down on his paws and shot me a worried look. I said, "Listen, I hope you don't mind if I slide on in, because any minute your neighbor's going to look out the window and catch sight of my hiney bumper hanging out the doggy door. If you have any objections, speak now or forever hold your peace." I waited, but the dog never even bared his gums. Using my elbows for leverage, I completed ingress, saying, "Nice dog. What a good pooch," and similar kiss-ass phrases. His tail began to thump with hope. Maybe I was the little friend his dad had promised would come and play with him. Once inside the kitchen, I began to rise to my feet. This, in the dog's mind, converted me into a beast that might require savaging. He leapt up, head down, ears back, beginning an experimental growl, his entire chest wall vibrating like a swarm of bees on the move. I sank down to my original submissive position. "Good boy," I murmured, humbly lowering my gaze. I waited while the dog tested the parameters of his responsibility. The growling faded in due course. I tried again. Lifting onto my hands and knees seemed acceptable, but the minute I tried to stand up, the growling started up again. Make no mistake about it, this dog meant business. "You're very strict," I said. I waited a few moments and tried yet again. This time the effort netted me a furious bark. "Okay, okay." The big guy was beginning to get on my nerves. In theory, I was close enough to the doggy door to effect an escape, but I was fearful of going head first, thus exposing my rear end. I was also worried about going feet first, lest the dog attack my upper body while I was wedged in the opening. Meanwhile, the kitchen clock was ticking like a time bomb, forcing a decision. The curtain or the box? I could visualize Ted Rich barreling down the highway in my direction. I had to do something. Still on my hands and knees, I crawled forward a step. The dog watched with vigilance, but made no menacing gesture. Slowly, I headed across the kitchen floor toward the front of the house. The dog tagged along beside me, his toenails clicking on the grimy linoleum, his full attention focused on my plodding journey. Already, I realized I hadn't really thought this thing through, but I'd been so intent on my ends I hadn't fully formulated the means. Baby-like in my romper, I traversed the dining room, bypassed the motorcycle, and entered the living room. This was carpeted, but otherwise contained little in the way of interest. I crawled down the hallway with the dog keeping pace. his head hanging down till his gaze was level with mine. I suppose I should state right here that what I was doing isn't routine behavior for a private eye. My conduct was more typical of someone intent on petty theft, too mulish and impetuous to use legitimate means, provided she could think of any. In the law enforcement sector, my actions would be classified as trespass, burglary, and given the key picks in my pocket, possession of burglary tools, California Penal Code sections 602, 459, and 466, respectively. I hadn't stolen anything, yet, and the item I was after was purely intellectual, but it was nonetheless illegal to squirm through a doggy door and start crawling down a hall. Caught in the act, I'd be subject to arrest and conviction, perhaps forfeiting my license and my livelihood. Well, dang. All this for a man I'd left after less than 9 months of marriage. The house wasn't large. A bath and two bedrooms, plus the living room, dining room, kitchen, and laundry room. I must say the world is very boring at an altitude of 18 inches. All I could see were chair legs, carpet snags, and endless stretches of dusty baseboard. No wonder house pets, when left alone, take to peeing on the rugs and gnawing on the furniture. I passed a door on the left that led back into the kitchen, with the laundry room to one side. When I reached the next door on the left, I crawled in and surveyed the premises, mentally wagging my tail. Unmade double bed, night table, chest of drawers, doggy bed, and dirty clothes on the floor. I did a U-turn and crawled into the room across the hall. Rich was using this one as a combination den and home office. Along the wall to my right, he had a row of banged-up file cabinets and a scarred oak desk. He also had a Barca lounger and a television set. The dog climbed on the recliner with a guilty look, watching to see if I was going to swat his hairy butt. I smiled my encouragement. As far as I was concerned, the dog could do anything he wanted. I made my way over to the desk. I'm getting up to take a peek now, so don't get your knickers in a twist, okay? By now, the dog was bored, and he yawned so hard I could hear a little squeak at the back of his throat. Carefully, I eased into a kneeling position and searched the surface of the desk. There on a stack of papers lay the answer to my prayers. A sheaf of documents, among them the receipt for Rich's payment to the San Felipe Self-Storage Company, dated Saturday, May 17. I tucked the paper in my mouth, sank down on all fours, and crawled to the door. Since the dog had lost interest, I was able to make quick work of the corridor in front of me. Crawling rapidly, I rounded the corner and thumped across the kitchen floor. When I reached the back door, I grabbed the knob and pulled myself to my feet. Exploits like this aren't as easy as they used to be. The knees of my coveralls were covered with dust, and I brushed off some woofies with a frown of disgust. I took the receipt out of my mouth, folded it, and stuck it in the pocket of my coveralls. When I glanced through the back door to make sure the coast was clear, I spotted my clipboard still sitting on the porch rail where I'd left it. I was just chiding myself for not tucking it someplace less conspicuous when I heard the sound of gravel popping and the front of Rich's pickup appeared in my field of vision. He pulled to a stop, cranked on the handbrake, and opened the door. By the time he got out, I'd taken six giant steps backward, practically levitating as I fled through the kitchen to the laundry room where I slid behind the open door. Rich had slammed the truck door, and he was apparently now making his way to the back porch. I heard him clump up the back steps. There was a pause wherein he seemed to make some remark to himself. He'd probably found my clipboard and was puzzling at its import. The dog had heard him, of course, and he was up like a shot, hurtling for the back door as fast as he could. My heart was thumping so loud it sounded like the clothes dryer trying to spin a load of wet towels. I could see my left breast vibrating against the front of my coveralls. I couldn't swear to this, but I think I may have wee-weed ever so slightly in my underpants. Also, I noticed the cuff of my pant leg was now protruding through the crack in the door. I'd barely managed to conceal myself when Rich clattered in the back door and tossed the clipboard on the counter. He and the dog exchanged a ritual greeting. On the part of the dog, much joyous barking and leaps. On Rich's part, a series of exhortations and commands, none of which seemed to have any particular effect. The dog had forgotten my intrusion, sidetracked by the merriment of having his master home. I heard Rich move through the living room and proceed down the hall, where he entered his office and flipped on the television set. Meanwhile, the dog must have been tickled by a tiny whisper of recollection because he set off in search of me, his nose close to the floor. Hide and seek, what fun, and guess who is it? He rousted me in no time, spying my coverall. Just to show how smart he was, he actually seemed to press one eye to the crack before he gave my pant leg a tug. He shook his head back and forth, growling with enthusiasm while he yanked on my cuff. Without even thinking, I poked my head around the door and raised a finger to my lips. He barked with enthusiasm, thus releasing me, and then he pranced back and forth, hoping I would play. I have to say, it was pathetic to see an 80-pound mutt having that much fun at my expense. Rich, unaware of the cause, bellowed orders to the pooch, who stood there torn between obedience to his master and the thrill of discovery. Rich called him again, and he bounded away with a series of exuberant yelps. In the den again, Rich told him to sit, and apparently he sat. I heard him bark once to alert his master there was game afoot. I didn't dare delay. Moving with a silence I hoped was absolute, I slipped to the back door and opened it a crack. I was on the brink of escape when I remembered my clipboard, which was resting on the counter where Rich had tossed it. I paused long enough to grab it, and then I eased out the back door and closed it carefully behind me. I crept down the porch steps and veered left along the drive, tapping the clipboard casually against my thigh. My impulse was to bolt as soon as I reached the street, but I forced myself to walk, not wanting to call attention to my exodus. There's nothing so conspicuous as someone in civilian clothes running down the street as though pursued by beasts. The drive back to Santa Teresa was uneventful, though I was so juiced up on adrenaline I had to make a conscious effort not to speed. I seemed to see cops everywhere, two at an intersection directing traffic where a stoplight was on the fritz, one lurking near the on-ramp concealed by a clump of bushes, another parked on the berm behind a motorist who waited in resignation for the ticket to come. Having escaped from the danger zone, I was not only being meticulous about obeying the law, but struggling to regain a sense of normalcy, whatever that is. The risk I'd taken at Teddy's house had fractured my perception. I'd become, at the same time, disassociated from reality and more keenly connected to it, so that real life now seemed flat and strangely lusterless. Cops, rock stars, soldiers, and career criminals all experienced the same shift. The plunge from soaring indomitability to unconquerable lassitude, which is why they tend to hang out with others of their ilk. Who else can understand the high? You get amped, wired, blasted out of your tiny mind on situational stimulants. Afterwards, you have to talk yourself down, reliving your experience until the charge is off and events collapse back to their ordinary size. I was still awash with the rush, my vision shimmering. The Pacific pulsated on my left. The sea air felt as brittle as a sheet of glass. Like flint on stone, the late morning sun struck the waves in a series of sparks until I half expected the entire ocean to burst into flames. I turned on the radio, tuning the station to one with booming music. I rolled down the car windows and let the wind buffet my hair. As soon as I got home, I set the cardboard box on the desk, pulled the storage company receipt from my pocket, and tossed the coveralls in the wash. I never should have broken into Teddy's house that way. What was I thinking? I was nuts, temporarily deranged. But the man had irritated me beyond reason. All I'd wanted was a piece of information, which I now possessed. Of course, I had no idea what to do with it. The last thing I needed was to reconnect with my ex. We'd parted on bad terms, and I'd made a point of abolishing my memories of him. Mentally, I'd excised all reference to the relationship, so that now I scarcely allowed myself to remember his name. Friends were aware that I'd been married at the age of 21, but they knew nothing of who he was and had no clue about the split. I'd put the man in a box and dropped him to the bottom of my emotional ocean, where he'd languished ever since. Oddly enough, my second husband, Daniel, had betrayed me, gravely injuring my pride. He hadn't violated my sense of honor as Mickey Magruder had. While I may be careless about the penal code, I'm never casual about the law. Mickey had crossed the line, and he'd tried dragging me along with him. I'd moved out on short notice, willing to abandon most of my belongings when I walked out the door. The overload of chemicals began to drain from my system, letting anxiety in. I went into my kitchenette and tranquilized myself with the ritual of a sandwich, smoothing Jif extra crunchy peanut butter on two slices of hearty 7-grain bread. I arranged 6 bread and butter pickles like big green polka dots on the thick layer of caramel-colored goo. I cut the finished sandwich on the diagonal and laid it on a paper napkin while I licked the knife clean. One virtue of being single is not having to explain the peculiarities of one's appetites in moments of stress. I popped open a can of Diet Coke and ate at the kitchen counter, perched on a stool with a copy of Time magazine, which I read back to middle. Nothing in the front ever seems to interest me. When I finished, I crumpled the paper napkin and tossed it in the trash, then returned to my desk. I was ready to go through the box of memorabilia, though I half dreaded what I would find. So much of the past is encapsulated in the odds and ends. Most of us discard more information about ourselves than we ever care to preserve. Our recollection of the past is not simply distorted by our faulty perception of events remembered, but skewed by those forgotten. The memory is like orbiting twin stars, one visible, one dark, the trajectory of what's evident forever affected by the gravity of what's concealed. I sat down in my swivel chair and tilted back on its axis. I propped my feet on my desk, the box open on the floor beside me. A hasty visual survey suggested that the minute I'd walked out, Mickey'd packed everything of mine he could lay hands on. I pictured him carting the box through the apartment, snatching up my belongings, tossing them together in a heap. I could see dried-out toiletries, a belt, junk mail, and old magazines rubber-banded in a bundle, 5 paperback novels, and a couple of pairs of shoes. Any other clothes I'd left were long gone. He'd probably shoved those in a trash bag and called the Salvation Army, taking satisfaction in the idea that many much-loved articles would end up on a sale table for a buck or two. He must have drawn the line at memorabilia. Some of it was here, at any rate, spared from the purge. I reached in and fumbled among the contents, letting my fingers make the selection among the unfamiliar clusters, a grab bag of the misplaced, the bygone, and the abandoned. The first item I retrieved was a packet of old report cards, bound together with thin white satin ribbon. These my Aunt Jin had saved for reasons that escaped me. She wasn't sentimental by nature, and the quality of my academic performance was hardly worth preserving. I was a quite average student, showing no particular affinity for reading, writing, or arithmetic. I could spell like a champ, and I was good at memory games. I liked geography and music, and the smell of LePage's paste on black and orange construction paper. Most other aspects of school were terrifying. I hated reciting anything in front of classmates, or being called on perversely when my hand wasn't even raised. The other kids seemed to enjoy the process, while I quaked in my shoes. I threw up almost daily, and when I wasn't sick at school, I would try to manufacture some excuse to stay home or go to work with Aunt Jin. Faced with aggression on the part of my classmates, I quickly learned that my most effective defense was to bite the shit out of my opponent. There was nothing quite as satisfying as the sight of my teeth marks in the tender flesh of someone's arm. There are probably individuals today who still bear the wrathful half-moon of dental scars. I sorted through the report cards, all of which were similar and shared a depressingly common theme. Scanning the written comments, I could see that my teachers were given to much hand-wringing and dire warnings about my ultimate fate. Though cursed with potential, I was apparently a child with little to recommend her. According to their notes, I daydreamed, wandered the classroom at will, failed to finish lessons, seldom volunteered an answer, and usually got it wrong when I did. Kinsey's bright enough, but she seems absent-minded, and she has a tendency to focus only on subjects of interest to her. Her copious curiosity is offset by an inclination to mind everybody else's business, dot, dot, dot. Kinsey seems to have difficulty telling the truth. She should be evaluated by the school psychologist to determine, dot, dot, dot. Kinsey shows excellent comprehension and mastery of topics that appeal to her, but lacks discipline, dot, dot, dot. Doesn't seem to enjoy team sports. Doesn't cooperate with others on class projects, dot, dot, dot. Able to work well on her own, dot, dot, dot. Undisciplined, unruly, timid, easily upset when reprimanded. Given to sudden disappearances when things don't go her way. Leaves classroom without permission. I studied my young self as though reading about a stranger. My parents had been killed in a car wreck on a Memorial Day weekend. I turned 5 on May 5th that year, and they died at the end of that month. In September, I started school armed with a lunchbox, my tablet paper, a No. 2 pencil, and a lot of gritty determination. From my current vantage point, I can see the pain and confusion I hadn't dared experience back then. Though physically undersized and fearful from day one, I was autonomous, defiant, and as hard as a nut. There was much I admired about the child I had been. The ability to adapt, the resilience, the refusal to conform. These were qualities I still harbored, though perhaps to my detriment. Society values cooperation over independence, obedience over individuality, and niceness above all else. The next packet contained photos from that same period. In class pictures, I was usually half a head shorter than anyone else in my class. My countenance was dark, my expression solemn and wistful, as if I longed to be gone, which of course I did. While others in the class stared directly at the camera, my attention was inevitably diverted by something taking place on the sidelines. In one photograph, my face was a blur because I'd turned my head to look at someone in the row behind me. Even then, life must have seemed more interesting, slightly off-center. What I found unsettling was the fact that I hadn't changed much in the years between. I probably should have been out somewhere looking for new clients instead of allowing myself to be distracted by the past. What could have happened that would result in Mickey's belongings being sold at public auction? Not that it was any of my business, but then again, that's exactly what gave the question its appeal. I went back to the cardboard box and pulled out an old tape recorder as big as a hardback book. I'd forgotten that old thing, accustomed by now to machines the size of a deck of cards. I could see a tape cassette inside. I pushed the play button. No go. The batteries were probably already dead the day Mickey tossed it in the box with everything else. I opened my desk drawer and took out a fresh pack of C batteries, shoving 4 end to end into the back of the machine. I pushed play again. This time the spindles began to turn and I heard my own voice. Some rambling account of the case I was working at the time. This was like historical data sealed in a cornerstone, meant to be discovered later after everyone was gone. I turned it off and set the tape machine aside. I reached into the box again. Tucked down along the side, I found ammo for the 9mm Smith & Wesson Mickey'd given me for a wedding present. There was no sign of the gun, but I could remember how thrilled I'd been with the gift. The finish on the barrel had been S&W blue, and the stock was checked walnut with S&W monograms. We'd met in November and married the following August. By then, he'd been a cop for almost 16 years, while I'd joined the department in May, a mere 3 months before. I took the gift of a firearm as an indication that he saw me as a colleague, a status he'd accorded few women in those days. Now I could see that there were larger implications. I mean, what kind of guy gives his young bride a semi-automatic on their wedding night? Impulsively, I pulled open my bottom drawer, searching for the old address book, where I'd tucked the only forwarding information I'd ever had for him. The phone number had probably been relinquished and reassigned half a dozen times, the address just as long out of date. I was interrupted by a knock. I hauled my feet off the desk and crossed to the door, peering through the porthole, to find my landlord standing on the porch. Henry was wearing long pants for a change, and his expression was distracted as he stared out across the yard. He'd turned 86 on Valentine's Day, tall and lean, a man who never actually seemed to age. He and his siblings, who were respectively 88, 89, 95, and 96, came from such vigorous genetic stock that I'm inclined to believe they'll never actually pass. Henry's handsome in the manner of a fine antique, handcrafted and well-constructed, exhibiting a polish that suggests close to 9 decades of loving use. Henry has always been loyal, outspoken, kind, and generous. He's protective of me in ways that feel strange, but welcome nonetheless. I open the door. Hi, Henry. What are you up to? I haven't seen you for days. Thank goodness you're home. I have a dental appointment in... He paused to glance at his watch. Approximately 16 3/4 minutes, and both my cars are out of commission. I finally put the Chevy in the shop after that paint can fell on it, and now I discover the station wagon's dead. Can you give me a lift? Better yet, if you lend me your car, I can save you the trip. This is going to take a while, and I hate to tie you up. Henry's 5-window, butter-yellow, 1932 Chevy coupe had suffered some minor damage when several paint cans shuddered off the garage shelf during a cluster of baby earthquakes late in March. Henry was meticulous about the car, keeping it in pristine condition. His second vehicle, the station wagon, he used whenever his Michigan-based sibs came to town. I'll give you a ride. I don't mind a bit, I said. Let me grab my keys. I left the door ajar while I snagged my handbag from the counter and fished out the keys from the outer compartment. I picked up my jacket while I was at it and then pulled the door shut behind me. We rounded the corner of the building and passed through the gate. I unlocked the VW on the passenger side and moved around the front of the car. He leaned across the seat and unlocked the door on my side. I slid under the wheel, fired up the ignition, and we were underway.
Great. This is great. I really appreciate this, Henry said, his tone completely false.
I glanced over at him, making note of the tension that had tightened his face. What are you having done?
A crown, back here, he said,
talking with his fingers stuck at the back of his mouth. At least it's not a root canal.
I'd have to kill myself first. I was hoping you'd be gone so I could cancel the appointment.
No such luck, I said. Henry and I share an apprehension about dentists that borders on the comical. While we're both dutiful about checkups, we agonize over any work that actually has to be done. Both of us are subject to dry mouth, squirmy stomachs, clammy hands, and lots of whining. I reached over and felt his fingers, which were icy and faintly damp. Henry frowned to himself.
I don't see why he has to do this. The filling's fine, really, not a problem. It doesn't even hurt. It's a little sensitive to heat, and I've had to give up anything with ice.
The filling's old.
1942, but there's nothing wrong with it.
Talk about make work.
My point exactly. In those days, dentists knew how to fill a tooth. It's planned obsolescence. Now a filling has a limited shelf life, like a carton of milk. You're lucky if it lasts you long enough to pay the bill.
He stuck his finger in his mouth again, turning his face in my direction.
He is. Only 15 years old, and the guy's already talking about replacing it.
You're kidding. What a scam.
Remember when they put fluoride in the city water and everybody thought it was a communist plot? Dentists spread that rumor.
Of course they did, I said, chiming in on cue. They saw the handwriting on the wall. No more cavities, no more business. We went through the same duet every time either one of us had to have something done.
Now they've cooked up that surgery where they cut half your gums away. If they can't talk you into that, they claim you need braces.
What a crock, I said.
I don't know why I can't have my teeth pulled and get it over with, he said, his mood becoming morose.
I made the usual skeptical response. I wouldn't go that far, Henry. You have beautiful teeth.
I'd rather keep them in a glass. Can't stand the drilling. The noise drives me crazy. And the scraping when they scale, oh, I nearly ripped the arms off the chair. Sounds like a shovel on a sidewalk, a pickaxe on concrete.
All right, cut it out. You're making my hands sweat. By the time I pulled into the parking lot, we'd worked ourselves into such a state of indignation, I was surprised he was willing to keep the appointment. I sat in the dentist's waiting room after Henry's name was called. Except for the receptionist, I had the place to myself, which I thought was faintly worrisome. How come the dentist only had one patient? I pictured Medicaid fraud, phantom clients, double billing, charges for work that would never be done. Just a typical day in the life of Dr. Dentifris, federal con artist and cheater with a large sadistic streak. I did give the guy points for having recent issues of all the best magazines. From the other room, over the burbling of the fish tank, which is meant to mask the shrieks, I could hear the sounds of a high-speed drill piercing through tooth enamel straight to the pulsing nerve below. My fingers began to stick to the pages of People magazine, leaving a series of moist, round prints.